Good afternoon. If you have your Bible with you, would you take it out, please, and turn to the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. And it'll be worth your time to take out a Bible and turn over there to Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7, as that will provide the main text and the outline for our lesson this evening. That's Revelation chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. Seven different churches, local congregations of the Lord's church, each with their own problems, each with their own temptations, each with their own strengths and weaknesses. Each of them made up with a blend of people from different backgrounds, different social classes, different races. Some of these churches received praise mixed with blame, like Ephesus. Some of them received only blame, like Laodicea. And others, like the church we will study tonight, Philadelphia, received only praise. And so here is my first question this evening. Given a choice to attend any of these seven churches, if you had to be a part of one of them, where would you have wanted to attend? If you were a Christian in the first century in Asia Minor, which one? You see, this idea that is put forth by a lot of people, I think, that one local congregation is as good as another as long as they don't teach error, we're doing okay, that is not a biblical concept. The Bible has bad congregations. The Bible has okay congregations. The Bible has good congregations. And may I suggest the Bible also has great congregations. And I believe that it is the Lord's desire for every single one of His local congregations to be great. His desire for this congregation at Timberland Drive to be a great congregation, not as defined by the rest of the world, but as defined by Him. And don't misunderstand me. It is not that greatness that we generally think of with lots of numbers and those sorts of things that the Lord is concerned about. Only God determines what truly is great. And the greatest of these churches was probably that church in Philadelphia. And it is certainly the church, given a choice, that I would have liked most to have been a part of were I part of a church in first century Asia Minor. Yes, these seven churches of Asia had obstacles that they had to overcome, all of them, and yet the obstacles that we find here in Philadelphia are much different than many of the other obstacles that we see in the other churches. Spiritually speaking, this seems to be the healthiest of those churches. It is the only letter out of the seven that the Lord doesn't have anything negative to say about them. Now, Smyrna, the second church, they were faithful too, but they were going to have tribulation 10 days. They were about to go through the fiercest and harshest of all of the persecutions that were going to come upon these seven churches. Philadelphia, on the other hand, they had already persevered in their tribulation, whatever it was. And so God says, instead of having this trial and tribulation come upon them for this definite period of time, instead, God says that He's going to spare them from the hour of trial that's coming upon the whole world. So a church that is faithful, a church that is not going to experience a great deal of tribulation and persecution, and a church that has great opportunity in front of it. I don't know about you, but that's the kind of church that I want to be a part of. It's interesting that though this is the best in many ways of the seven churches, it is also the church about which we know the least. It is found here in the book of Revelation, and yet it's not mentioned anywhere else in the New Testament. And it is also the city about which we know the least. Certainly in terms of physical evidence, there is very little archaeological evidence to be found in this city of Philadelphia. But here's what we do know about that city. Philadelphia was a city of ancient Lydia in Asia Minor on the Cagamus River, and it was 25 or 30 miles south of Sardis. So let's go around the horn as we've done every night. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamus, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, right over here. And so 25 or 30 miles south-southeast of Sardis, we find this city of Philadelphia. The city dates back only to 159 B.C., and it was founded as a center for spreading the Greek language, culture, and manner. From the very beginning, it was established as some sort of perfect Hellenistic city by which Greek thoughts and ideals and religion and language might be spread throughout the rest of the world. It was, if you'll excuse the misuse of the term, it was a missionary city. But not for the gospel, not for Jesus Christ, for Hellenism, for Greek philosophy. It was for the promotion and loyalty to Greek ideals, and that is what it continued to be in the first century. As such, if you were going to establish a city that was intended to reach out to lots of places, where would you build it? Well, you would build it on a road, right? A road that was very busy. And so, as such, it was located on the main highway and trade route from Europe to the East. And with this perfect location, Philadelphia quickly became an important and wealthy trade center. One of the difficult things about studying Philadelphia throughout history, not just ancient history, is it's known by so many different names. It was known by at least four different names just in ancient history, including the nickname of Little Athens. So we think about Athens as being kind of the beating heart of Greece and of Greek philosophy. Well, this was Little Athens, if you want to put it in those terms. And so they had lots of temples there. They were trying to emulate Athens in that way. And we think about Paul going up to Mars Hill and seeing all the different gods and so forth. That's something that would have been found to a smaller degree in Philadelphia as well. The Greek god of vine and wine was the chief pagan deity of the city because there were a lot of grapes that were grown in this area. And in fact, they had no love lost for Domitian because Domitian at one point during his reign, he ordered that half of all of the grapevines be destroyed in Asia Minor and be replaced with wheat. Now, that was really short-sighted, because it takes about 7 years for a grapevine to produce fruit, and wheat doesn't grow very well in that area. And so what many of the people did there, especially in cities like Philadelphia, is they just ignored the command. And it was so poorly received that Domitian actually came back later and said, you know what, never mind. You can grow your grapes if you want to. As in most Asia Minor cities, they had many Jews that lived there, and those Jews possessed a synagogue. Now, having said all that, what is it that this city had to overcome? Not persecution. They had already persevered against that. Certainly, they might experience a little bit of that, but God said that ultimately He was going to spare them the worst of that. False doctrine? Well, there maybe was some of that coming into the city, but we don't see them giving in to any of that. Ultimately, what they had to overcome were obstacles to opportunity. What they had in front of them was an awesome opportunity. And what God requires of them is to make the most of it. So if you'll read with me, beginning there in verse 7, we'll start our study of this church. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 7. And to the messenger of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says He who is holy, He who is true, He who has the key of David, who opens and no one shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, and have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie, indeed I will make them come and worship before your feet to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command, my word, to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. To he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. As we have said every time, we have ears, and we are ready to hear and learn from this church in Philadelphia. If this is indeed the best of these seven churches, what is it that we need to learn from them, that we need to emulate so that we might be like them as well? As these letters always do, it begins by describing Christ. And it describes Him as the one who is holy. He is perfect. He is pure. The one who is true. He is the real Messiah. He is the genuine article. And then He says, He who has the key of David, He who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. The key of David identifies Christ with the rule and throne promised to David's seed. It identifies Christ as the Lion of Judah, as He's going to be described in chapter 5. This is the Messianic King, coming in all of His power and all of His authority. And key, specifically, is a symbol implying that power and authority that He has. And we read through the New Testament, and it's difficult for us not to read over and over the power and authority that Jesus possesses, especially as He has been exalted back to the right hand of God. We know from Matthew 28 and verse 18 that Christ has total and complete rule in heaven and on earth. Well, what's missing? Very little. But specifically, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 22 says that He has power over angels and authorities and all powers. Ephesians 1 verses 20 and 22 says that He has power over the church, that He is the head of the church and the ruler of it. Even here in the book of Revelation, in the first chapter in verse 5, it says that He has authority and power over the kings of the earth. In chapter 1 and verse 18, He has power over Hades, over death. Christ has the power. And Christ is the one who can execute that power. And so we might put it in these terms for what it is He's trying to communicate to us. Christ has the power to open and close doors. And let me say this very clearly. If Christ opens a door, it's not going to close until He says it's time to close it. And if Christ closes a door, that door's not going to open until Christ says it's time to open it. And so what does He say here? I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door. You know, there are a lot of things in the book of Revelation that are difficult to figure out. There are a lot of things where we kind of had to piece together and say, okay, what is it that this is really talking about? We've talked about those things on Wednesday nights. But this is pretty explicit, isn't it? In terms of, He says, there is one with all power and authority. If He opens a door, it stays open. If He closes a door, it stays closed. I have set before you an open door. Well, who is it that opened that door? Christ. And no one can shut it, He says. For you have a little power, a little strength. Well, what was keeping the door open? Was it their little power, their little strength? No, it was the power of the one who had all authority and all might and all dominion. We know that door indicates an opportunity, an opening through which a goal could be achieved. And in the Old Testament, that metaphor of door is used in several ways. Sin lies at the door of hope. And as we continue into the New Testament, we can make application to all sorts of doors. The door of opportunity that we might help other people. The door of opportunity to learn from others. The door of opportunity for salvation or to go to heaven. The lost opportunity when the door of judgment is shut upon us. But we especially think about open doors in terms of what? This is almost a Bible class. In terms of what? In spreading the gospel. That's exactly right. In terms of evangelism, in terms of preaching the gospel. Now remind me again, Philadelphia was established as what kind of city? A missionary city for Hellenistic culture. And He says, you have an awesome opportunity set before you. An opportunity to evangelize. An opportunity to spread the gospel. And there are lots of things that might have contributed to that opportunity. Well, they were in Philadelphia too. If they picked this as a great place to spread Hellenistic culture, it was probably a great place to spread the gospel as well. Their location would play into that, that lots of people are coming through, and then those people would spread to all of the places they were from to the east, all of the places that they were from toward Greece and Italy and Europe. And so they could spread the gospel out from this place. Their location gave them a great opportunity. And He does say that they have a little strength, a little power. And so it seems that they had resources at their disposal, whatever those resources were. And that gave them an opportunity to spread the gospel. But may I say to you very clearly that the only thing that ultimately gave them this opportunity was the providence of God. It was Jesus Christ. And I was listening this morning to Harold's lesson, talking about being in Christ and the things that we received. And specifically, he talked about the power that we have from Christ. The power that we have to influence things. And how do we gain access to that power? Well, we have to become a Christian, obviously. But he took us to Matthew chapter 7, remember? And talked about the power that we have in prayer. We influence the providence of God. In other words, God works in our lives in ways that we do not see, in ways that we do not understand, in ways that we do not know. Sometimes we can look back, and they say hindsight is 20/20. Sometimes we can look back and say, you know what, I'm pretty sure that was God working right there, because all of these things came together to bring me to this place where I needed to be spiritually. But ultimately, that power is influenced by my prayers and your prayers. You ever thought about that? The power of God to work providentially in this whole world, and specifically in the lives of you and the people you come in contact with, is influenced by your prayers. And as Harold said again this morning from the book of James, sometimes we do not have because we do not ask. These brethren had before them this awesome door of opportunity, this door to preach the gospel, this door to influence others. And I want a door like that for this congregation, don't you? And may I suggest prayer has a place in opening these doors. That begins by praying fervently in faith for open doors. We need to be praying for these doors. Praying that God will open them, that Christ will open them, because He is the one that has the power to do so. You know who's really good about this is Ty Thornton. He's not going to like me saying this, but I'm going to say it. Ty has prayed for this. I preached a sermon talking about praying for doors of opportunity, I don't know, years ago. And sometimes he prays that in his prayers, and I think to myself, Reagan, you need to do better about that. You need to be praying. Praying fervently. Praying daily. Pray every prayer for that matter. For doors of opportunity that I can shine the light of the gospel into the lives of others. And this is not some magic formula, but that's where the whole process needs to start. Praying for those open doors does two things for us. Number one, we know that God answers faithful, persistent prayer. It gets His power working to bring about conditions where a door might be opened. But secondly, just like Ty coming up and praying that publicly, and may I encourage us to do that publicly, to pray for opportunities for the gospel, pray for God to open doors. But when that happens, what does it do? It reminded me I need to be praying for that. And when we pray for it personally in our own lives, what does it remind us of? I need to be looking for those opportunities. You know, I think God gives us open doors all the time. But one of the things that we have trouble with sometimes is seeing those open doors. And so that's the second thing we need to pray for. We need to pray for the wisdom to see the open doors and then the courage to walk through those doors. And sometimes I think we're pretty hard on ourselves in regard to this. You've probably been through a scenario like this, just like I have. You're in a conversation with someone, maybe it's someone that you're pretty close with, and something comes up, something of a spiritual nature, and you have been working and you've been planning and you've been preparing, but the opportunity comes up and for whatever reason you're caught off guard by that opportunity. And the opportunity passes. And you say to yourself, there it is, I've wasted it. We can get pretty hard on ourselves about that. And there's some legitimacy that we need to do a better job. But may I suggest that even the fact that we see and recognize and realize there was an opportunity there is a good thing. Because what should we do? What should I have said in that moment? What should I have done in that moment? Play it through in your head. This is what I should have done, so
when I pray to God to give me another opportunity, another open door, I'll be ready. And I pray that God will give me the courage. The courage to say in love and kindness, seasoned with salt, what needs to be said to make the most of that opportunity. And then, as we should do with all prayer, we need to pray in thanksgiving to God when that door is opened, when that door is walked through, that it was not something that I did. Not really. I have a little strength, a little power, but it was Christ who gave me the opportunity. And I need to thank Him when that opportunity is found, seen, and taken. So, the opportunity is going to be there for us. Can I say that boldly? You, yes you, I don't care who you are, you are going to have the opportunity to share the gospel with somebody. You're going to have it. The door is going to be open. And Christ is the one who's going to open it for you. So how do we walk through it? How do we take advantage of it? How do we accomplish what is before us? Well, may I suggest that we learn from this text that a little power is all we need with Christ. See, I have set before you an open door and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, a little power, have kept my word and have not denied my name. This church here in Philadelphia, we don't know much at all about this congregation, and they may not have had great numbers, they may not have had great wealth, they may not have had great social status. And may I go so far as to say they may have had much less wealth and power and social status than this church. But it had power sufficient to serve Christ's purposes. Because Christ has always used those with just a little power, used those with just a little strength. What is it that he says back there in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 about those who are called, those who accept that calling? Well, he says in 1 Corinthians 1 in verse 26, "For you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise, according to the flesh, not many mighty, according to the flesh, not many noble, according to the flesh, are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen. And the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, the unseen things. That no flesh should glory in His presence." Because ultimately it's not about me and my power and my might. It's about the power of God. And that's what's going to change the hearts and minds of individuals. But notice, he doesn't say you have no strength, you have no power. What Christ says, that little power, that little strength that you have, you can use it. And I can use it to accomplish my purposes. A little power is made great when it is used for God's purposes. Our power, however little it might be, is sufficient to serve Christ's purposes. Amen? Do you believe that? Whatever small opportunities you have, with whatever people you come in contact with, Christ can use it. And He will, if we allow Him to. I am reminded of one of my favorite phrases in all of the Scriptures. Don't despise the day of small things. We might say, don't despise the day of little power in terms of what he says here in Revelation. But turn back to Zechariah chapter 4, where that phrase is found. In Zechariah chapter 4, this is in the context of the rebuilding of the temple after the return from Babylonian captivity. Begin reading with me in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 9. So the foundation of the temple was laid. They quit working for about 20 years. And so Haggai and Zechariah, they come back as prophets from God and they say, the reason why you're having so much trouble is because you're not putting God first. You need to rebuild the temple. And so ultimately there are going to be some guys who do just that. And one of those leaders was Zerubbabel. And so he says in verse 9 of Zechariah chapter 4, "The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands shall also finish it. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you."
For who has despised the day of small things? For these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of the Lord which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. And it's interesting in the context of the book of Revelation, he's talked about seven lampstands. He's talked about seven eyes, which are the eyes of God looking across all of the earth. And he says, God sees what you are doing. This little bitty group of people in this seemingly, and I don't use this term flippantly, but in the way in which it was originally coined, this seemingly God-forsaken little piece of earth where the Babylonians came and wiped it clean, and now a few stragglers, a little remnant, comes back and they're going to rebuild this little temple. Haggai tells us that there were those there who remembered the glory of Solomon's temple. And so these people would have been, 80 years old maybe, something like that. But they remembered what Solomon's temple looked like. And when the foundation was laid of the new temple, they wept because they knew it could never live up. Never live up to what Solomon's temple was. And so what does God reveal to Haggai, the contemporary of Zechariah? He says, I am going to make the glory of this temple greater than the glory of Solomon's temple. And so what they are reminded of here in Zechariah chapter 4 is don't despise the day of small things. God asks this question of those people, is it not as nothing in your eyes? But then he says, it's going to be as something in my eyes. It's going to have greater glory. And if we are mature enough to see things through God's eyes, then we can see things for all of the glory that they truly are. And we say, we ask to ourselves, what can I possibly do in evangelism? Well, may I say something kind of cliche? Hopefully I haven't said too many cliche things already. If you can influence one person, to accept Christ, to put him on in baptism, to live faithfully and go to heaven, in the eyes of many, that is a small thing. But in the eyes of God, the angels in heaven rejoice over one soul. And that is cliche. I mean, we've heard that, haven't we? Stephanie and I were in Tampa this past week. I just got in yesterday afternoon. And Jim Smitherman, Joe's son, was there as well. And we were at a leadership conference at Florida College. That's our alma mater, and we work in the camps in the summer. You're familiar with that. That's something that we do as well. And so Jim was there making a presentation along those lines, and he used that very imagery. He said, if we can influence one child by the things that we're doing to come to a Florida College camp, and if we can influence one of those kids to come to Florida College, and if that makes some sort of eternal difference in their lives, isn't all of this work and so forth worth it? Can I confess something to you? In that moment, as I thought about the hundreds of hours that we pour into working those camps and doing all of that stuff, and I think about all of the years that we've done that in the past, and God willing, all of the years that we do that in the future, I thought to myself, just for one? But then he said this, it's worth it if that one is your kid. What if all we do in all of our years here on this earth, like Noah, is save our children? Praise God. It is a door of opportunity that we have taken advantage of. And yet we know that God is going to place other doors of opportunity in our path. And whatever we can do in His service, whatever little strength we can use, that's what we need to do. And it comes back to that phrase that we need to love our neighbor as ourself. If I am that one that is saved, then that is a big thing to me, isn't it? And if they are that one that I can influence, it is a huge thing, an eternal thing for them. The devil uses discouragement against us by telling us that the things we're doing don't matter that much. But if we're doing God's will, it matters to God. It is pleasing to Him. And that's all that really matters. When we have a little power to be faithful and take advantage of our opportunities. So we've prayed about it. We've committed to it with whatever little power we have. So what is it that we are going to do? Well, may I suggest that there are five things that every single one of us can do in terms of sharing the gospel. Every single one of us can shine our lights. Every single one of us can live our calling in the lives that we've been given. Whether we're old or whether we're young, whether we're well known or nobody knows us, whether we have lots of friends or just a few friends, wherever we are, whatever stage of life we're in and whatever influence we have, we can live faithfully and shine our lights. Every single one of us can do that. Raise your hand if you can't. Don't you dare raise your hand. Every single one of us can open our eyes. Every single one of us can look outside of ourselves to look to somebody else. What are their needs? How can I serve them? Where are these opportunities? Every single one of us can open our eyes to look and see what God places before us with open doors. Every single one of us can open our mouths. Some of us are better at that than others. But some of us are awfully good at opening our mouths about lots of different things. Lots of things like the football team that we love. We're really good at opening our mouths about our children and how much we're proud of them. We're really good at opening our mouths about our job because we're passionate about it. But we need to be good about opening our mouths to pray to God and opening our mouths to start spiritual conversations or join spiritual conversations with other people to turn those things toward the spiritual, especially with those with whom we have some sort of influence. Every single one of us can invite someone to services. Every single one of us can open our mouths to stand up for someone who can't stand up for themselves. And every time we do that, we are opening our mouth for Christ. Every single one of us can open our hearts. We can have empathy for those who are lost, to feel what they feel. And maybe they don't even realize what they ought to be feeling. That they're dead in trespasses and sins. And how would I want someone to treat me if I was in that condition? Every single one of us can open our hearts to other people to try and serve them in whatever small way that we can. To welcome someone when they come to the assembly. To show hospitality, to accept and support the one who desires to get out of sin. We can open our hearts to them. You know, the Apostle Paul, he was a big-hearted guy, but I don't think that came naturally to him. And yet, what does he say to those Corinthian brethren? We're studying about it in the back. Our hearts are wide open. Yeah, that's a paraphrase, but that's what he's saying. Our hearts are wide open to you. We love you. We care about you. And every single one of us can have that care and concern for others in regard to their need for the gospel. And so then we reach the point where every one of us, I think, sometimes feels inadequate. Yes, I feel inadequate in this area sometimes. But then I have to say something to try and bring them to the truth of the gospel. And I think we put too much pressure on ourselves with that. Because the last thing we need to open is our Bibles. We need to open our Bibles to show people the power of God's Word, not ours. Open our Bibles to get answers for ourselves and give answers to those who need them. Every single one of us can do those five things. And we will have the opportunities to do just that. And these brethren, they were going to do it. They were going to do these five things because they were faithful. And what we see in this text is that faithfulness is found in two very simple actions. We see the faithfulness to God summed up in two things a lot of places in Scriptures. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But in this passage, it is summed up in these two things. Keep His Word. Well, that's broad. And yet, keep the things that God tells us to do. And later he's going to tell them that's exactly what they did. And then do not deny his name. And yes, for them that might have been literal in the sense of you need to either curse God or die, deny Christ and confess Caesar or you're going to die. Maybe it was something that literal. But a lot of times for us, it's really just in our actions. It's in our lives. By the things that I'm doing, by the way that I'm living, am I confessing that Christ is most important to me? That I really am a Christian above all else? Or am I confessing by the things that I do loyalty and allegiance to someone or something else? I need to confess in word and deed. Do not deny his name. I'm a Christian. That's who I am. I will confess it daily and I will confess it practically. And if they were faithful, if they overcame, if they made the most of the evangelistic opportunity in front of them, what was it that God was going to do for them? We'll go back to Revelation chapter 3 one more time and read with me, beginning in verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, they kept his word, I also will keep you, protect you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Then notice verse 11. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. They had a crown. They had overcome, but they needed to continue to overcome. Verse 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more, he says. So the first thing that he says in describing how Christ provides permanent security and identity for those who overcome is that he will make them a pillar in the temple of my God. I think there's some context that really helps us about this. This area, Laodicea, Philadelphia, even Sardis, it's a volcanic region through there. There are lots of earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and especially in the first century, for whatever reason, there were lots of those. We've talked about that in our Revelation class. And so the city of Philadelphia was devastated by an earthquake. We talk about 100-year floods. It was a 100-year earthquake in 17 AD. And so the city rebuilt itself. And then in 23 AD, you know what happened? There was another 100-year earthquake. And the city was totally destroyed again. And there were smaller earthquakes that took place in the years following those two occasions. And living in an earthquake zone with multiple earthquakes, how would you feel? I'd feel pretty nervous. Ground starts to shake a little bit. What's going to happen? Well, if it gets too bad, lots of people are going to die and all the houses are going to be destroyed and we're going to have to rebuild again. It's something that we could relate to, I think, with 100-year floods. Seems like we've had a lot of 100-year floods in the last, 10 years, doesn't it? And there are even some folks here who can really and truly understand what that means because they've moved from that region with multiple floods in just a few years. And what happens when the flood water starts rising? You have to leave your home in a panic, and then you return to the devastation and have to rebuild again. Well, for them, it wasn't floods, it was earthquakes. But that's exactly what they had to do. And so what does God promise them? He will make them a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. What do you do when the earthquake starts? You have to leave the house, right? And he says, no, I'm going to make you solid. I'm going to make you stand, and you're going to have to go out no more. The pillar of God in the temple of God means that they are going to be in an unshakable position, where you don't have to leave, you don't have to worry, you don't have to be nervous. And it's interesting that there are pillars there now of a Byzantine church, these giant pillars that were built in the 600s AD. And I wonder, you see how big they are? These are gravestones down here. That's how huge these pillars are. And I wonder if the builders of this church building in the Byzantine area, they didn't read the words here in Revelation and say, we're going to make some big old pillars. But for the brethren who are actually reading this, the pillars that they would have associated with were the giant pillars that the Greeks built and that the Romans built as well. These are pillars from a temple to Artemis in Sardis, just up the road, 25 miles or so.
And they look big, but I don't think we truly grasp how big and tall that really is. Here's another picture. The quality's not quite as good, but you see these people next to these giant pillars, and these people are actually pretty close. Look at this person right here next to these giant pillars. And yet, are there any pillars like that in Philadelphia today? They've all been destroyed. It's interesting, though, that there's a pillar actually in the Met. I've seen this one in New York. You see, this is just the bottom of it and the top of it. It would have been much, much, much taller than this. But this is the gives you an idea of the size, the magnitude of these pillars. And Christ says, I'm going to make you a pillar that never falls. You are going to be a pillar in the temple of my God. They are going to be given an intimate, close place with God in His temple. Several places we are referred to as the temple of God. We think especially of Ephesians chapter 2. But even at the end of the book of Revelation, the temple of God refers to what? Well, turn to the end of Revelation. Revelation chapter 21. And verse 22, actually we could read these two whole chapters. We're not going to do that tonight. But I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city had no need of the sun or of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it, and the Lamb is its light. At the end of the book of Revelation, the temple of God is God and the Lamb. It refers to this place of heaven, the new Jerusalem. And God says, I will make you a permanent, stable pillar in that temple, and you will dwell with me eternally. And I will write on the one who overcomes. I will write on him a new name, he says. And this name indicates ownership and dedication. We think about a school building has that little plaque that says who the superintendent was, who the principal was, who the school board members were, who the architect was. Well, that plaque is going to be placed on us, and our builder and maker is going to be God. God is going to own us. And the city of Philadelphia was renamed several times, always in association with the ruler of that time. It was originally named after its founder, Attalus II Philadelphius of Pergamum. And he won that name Philadelphius, brotherly love, because of his loyalty and love to his brother, who was the previous ruler. It was called that when it was established in the BCs. But then, after that earthquake in 17 AD, Rome sent money to rebuild the city, and so they renamed themselves Neo Caesarea, New Caesar, because their leader had come and helped them. And then from 64 to 79 AD, it was not called Philadelphia or Neo Caesarea. It was called Flavia, after those Flavian emperors, including Vespasian. But by the 90s, and coincidentally, that gives us some historical insight into the dating of the book. By the 90s, it was known as Philadelphia again. This city had an identity problem. It was known by many names. We already talked about it being called New Athens or Little Athens. It was even named after another city. And Christ comes and he says, you're going to know your name. Not named after Philadelphius, not named after Caesar, not after named after the Flavian emperors. You're going to be named after me. The city didn't know their name. They didn't know to whom they belonged. And God says, you're going to know to whom you belong. You are going to be mine. You will be known by my name. And that name is going to be written in the Lamb's Book of Life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And if you're here this evening, you can be known by the name of Christ as well. You can be called a Christian if you come submitting yourself to Christ, saying, He is my ruler, He is my emperor, and I am going to be renamed in honor and service to Him. If you're willing to put Christ on in baptism, then He can raise you from the dead spiritually, that you might walk in newness of life. And if you're already a Christian this evening,
and you realize that you have not been living in a manner worthy of the name that you wear, make it right to ensure that you are a pillar in the church of God eternally, and that you wear that name, the name of Christ, forevermore. If you're subject to the gospel call in any way tonight, come now, while together we stand and while we sing. Jesus.